One of the classic stories of Americana is the story of Rip Van Winkle. It isn't a story unique to America. It comes in different forms in different countries. But in 1819, when Washington Irving published the story of Rip Van Winkle, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, it had a very special ring. It's, of course, the story that you know better than I do, brought up with it, as most of you were. It's the story of a Dutch colonial American living in a small Dutch village in the Catskill Mountains. Rip was a man who was gregarious and open, but he was lazy to the core of his being. And one day, to escape his wife, who was continually nagging him for very good reason, he took his dog and his squirrel gun and went off to hunt squirrels. And in the process, he came across a group up in the hills that were making merry in a particular way, and they invited him to join them, and he imbibed of their friendship and their time, and the liquor that they rather freely supplied to him, and then exhausted by the day and then overcome by what he had imbibed, he fell asleep, only to be awakened with the jangling of some bells and to awaken discovering some things seemed strangely to have changed. He only recognized that he'd fallen asleep for the night, but now he had a long white beard. And his gun, which had been so well oiled, had rusted, and his dog was nowhere to be found. Puzzled him, made his way into the village again, and as he walked in, it seemed strange to him. The buildings had been altered, some that he knew had vanished, and there were new ones there, and the people were dressed in very strange clothing that was not the kind he had on. And as a matter of fact, as he walked through the town, he not only didn't recognize anybody, but the children began to laugh and mock at him for the way he was dressed. And then he came to the inn where he'd spent a good deal of time hiding from his wife while he was imbibing. And in the front, he was used to the picture of King George and the notice that this was King George's inn. But now there was a new picture of some man he didn't quite recognize, but it still said George's Inn, only it said George Washington's Inn. And somehow he began to discover in the midst of that he'd fallen asleep and woken up 20 years later, and everything was strange and everything was kind of different, and he had, without knowing it, passed into a new world entirely. Well, when I read that story or think about it on different occasions, it somehow rings true in an interesting way. Not that I feel I've been sleeping for 20 years, although if I'm claiming this is my 50th anniversary or birthday, that's about right in terms of add a few more years to that. But the reality is, it seems sometimes as I look around at the world in which I'm in that it has somehow changed. That this is not the world I was brought up in. This was not the way it worked in that particular way. Those of you who are under 30 cannot begin to appreciate how in some ways unfamiliar the world. Now, there's the obvious ways. I mean, technology has changed everything. And it's hard to imagine that the iPhone is only slightly more than 10 years of age, but the whole world built around that and all the other technologies that are there and we take notice of in all kinds of different ways. The internet is, in terms of its public practice, not much more than 25 years old, maybe slightly more than that. But in all of those ways, the world has changed, but on more fundamental changes. There are things that take place every day in terms of our society that help us understand that we are living in a profoundly different world than we once lived in. We're almost not shocked by things that we see on television when I was a child would have immediately caused those channels to lose their licenses, and the language that's used and the language of songs that are taken for granted in different places and the coarseness of political discourse. But it's more the unraveling of the moral foundations of the society in which we live, that things that were once whispered about are now proclaimed publicly, and they are not simply flaunted, they are commanded that you get on board with them or you are going to be ostracized in different ways. and something very deep. We live in earthquake zones, and we know something about tectonic plates. It isn't simply that foundations are being challenged. It's in some way the tectonic plates of our time have shifted in major ways. I was struck by the fact that, just reading this morning, that on Memorial Day weekend, rather ironically, they have shut down the USS Arizona Memorial in Hawaii. And the reason is that one of the pilots of the boats that take you out there had noticed that there were some cracks in the loading area. And as they corrected it, they patched the cracks. But then a day later, they opened up again, and they realized, no, we're not dealing with something that can be patched. There's a structural issue that's involved here and an issue of safety, and we need to go back and examine it. It's not safe to be there. Now, all of that leads us to the passage that we're going to look at this morning. Because the passage talks about a people who looked at the world that was around them and said, the foundations are being destroyed. And how do we respond when the foundations are being destroyed? How do we live in that particular way? So I'm going to have you turn with me, because this feeling of shifting foundations, which can be very much the case, we know that a shifting foundation will mean ultimately the collapse of a building that's built upon it. But it wasn't just something we feel, it was something that was felt way back in David's time. And as David deals with the issue, he helps us understand something about how even we live in this kind of time and in this kind of way when we feel these kind of shakings of our society. And let me just say, I am having a birthday tomorrow. And it makes you aware that the clock of time is running out. But one of the things that disturbs me in other ways is thinking of the kind of challenges, if the Lord be not come, my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren are going to live in, the kind of challenges they're already facing. As, for example, the California government legislates kids to be taught things when they're 5 years of age that they shouldn't be taught at any age, and they're certainly not able to deal with at that particular age. And so, as an old guy, I recognize it's very easy for some of you who are younger to think, oh yeah, that's the way old codgers always talk, that it used to be better when we were younger. I don't think, in many ways, the United States was ever a good or great nation. Now, I think it was better than almost any other nation you could imagine, but it always had terrible sins that were part of it. Can't remember slavery or the Trail of Tears, and some of those other things without recognizing there were profound challenges. Would you want to live anywhere else in the world? No, I think that broken and depraved as the United States is, because it's full of depraved people like you and me, it still is a nation that has had a Judeo-Christian influence that's profound. But the future has shifted away from that. So how do we respond? Panic? Ignoring it? Or some other way? So David, in Psalm chapter 11, moves us into a discussion of that out of his own life. So let me read the psalm with you, and then we'll think our way through it. We finished 1 Peter last week. We're going to spend time here in Psalm 11 and another psalm next week, and then we'll move into another, a little more extended series. To the choir master, we read a psalm of David. In the Lord, in Yahweh, I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend their bow. They have strung their arrows, fixed their arrows for the strings, to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Yahweh, the Lord, is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of men. The Lord Yahweh tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the ones who love violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked, or he will rain coals on the wicked, fire and sulfur and brimstone. pardon me, and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. For Yahweh, the Lord, is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face. Isn't technology wonderful? And the worst part of it is, it's going to be a crank caller who has no interest. So let me just walk through the three parts of this. David begins with a great affirmation, and then he deals with a suggestion that's been given to others about him, and then in the last three or four verses, he has a great affirmation of his own basis of faith and trust. So as we come into the psalm, we notice that it's a psalm of David, but we don't know much about the details of it. What was the circumstance? What were you living through, David? What were the problems that were there? There's a clear and present danger. There are people who are threatening David and apparently threatening those around David. And they are sinister. They're sinister in such a way that those looking on feel the whole social fabric is unraveling. The whole structure of our society is underway, being under attack. And what's going on? Well, we can guess what's going on. Is this, for example, the two most possible suggestions? It's when he's under attack from Saul. When Saul's anger and hatred and insanity is growing, and he is pursuing David everywhere, and he's not only pursuing David, he's willing to throw spears at his own son and his daughter. His life is threatened by him, and he's killing the high priest or having him killed, and he's willing to kill other priests. He'll hunt down everything so that everything in society becomes unraveled because of the obsessive, maniacal pursuit of Saul against David. Or maybe it's at the other end of his life when Absalom is carrying out a coup, when he is trying to overthrow his father so he can be king in his place, so much so that David, the great king, who's built Israel to an extent that it's never been before, is forced to flee for his own life from the city because of the way Absalom has poisoned society against him. And Absalom's own pursuit of his own, everything is turned against his father. I think it's more likely the time of Saul. It may be the time of Absalom. It may be another time of which we are not told. But in the midst of this, David, as it were, nails his own commitment to the door, making it very clear in that first statement. In Yahweh, I take refuge. That's his personal identity. That's who he is as a man. He is a man who is a Yahweh refugee. Now, you need to look at both of those expressions. On the one sense, in Yahweh. Now, whenever you see the capital L-O-R-D in the Old Testament, it is the translators have chosen not to translate the actual Hebrew name, but to follow the Jewish custom, because they believe that name was too reverent to pronounce, of Yahweh, the God who came to Moses and said, I am that I am. But it's the personal name of God. So you have the name of God, Elohim, which is his sort of character, and you have his sovereign name. He is Lord, small L, capital L, small O-R-D. But this is his personal name. It is the name that he allows his people to call him because he's brought them into a covenant relationship with him. He's not simply their creator. He is their God who's come into a relationship with him. And in the New Testament, following what Jesus taught us, we recognize two things. First of all, Jesus is Yahweh. He is Lord. If you confess with your mouth, Jesus as Yahweh, Lord, is the very nature of salvation. We believe that Jesus is God become man, but we also believe that he's let us know him personally. As a matter of fact, the Christian name for God isn't Yahweh, it is Father. So what he is saying, and if we put it in Christian language, is saying in my Father, but he's thinking of the whole Trinity. So in Yahweh, I've taken refuge. David was a strong man. He was a strong king. He led a nation into victory after victory, and yet he knew himself to be a refugee, one who needed a place in this world in which we live when we see people moving in massive numbers from country to country because of their own weakness and their own inadequacy. We think of Syria and we think of what, 12 million people in Syria are refugees. And even whatever you think about the immigrant crisis in our country, you can't help but feel this brokenness of people who leave everything behind because they're so terrified of what it is. Where do we find a place where we'll be safe? And for David, that word was refuge to describe who God is to him. When no one else would take me in, God, you are my refuge. You're my stronghold. It's interesting that that is an expression that occurs 47 times in the book of Psalms. It's David's great description. Let me read some of those verses to you. Not all of them are from David, but they're all in the Psalm. Psalm 2, verse 12, blessed are all who take refuge in him. Psalm 7, 1, O Lord my God, in you I take refuge. Save me from all my pursuers and deliver me. Psalm 9, 9, the Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. Psalm 14, verse 6, you would shame the plans of those who attack the poor. The Lord is his, he's talking to the evil people, I'm reading this wrongly. You would shame the opponents, the evil people. You would shame the plans of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge. Psalm 34, verse 8, O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. Psalm 46, verse 1. This is a verse that many of us know. The Lord is our refuge and our strength, a proven help in time of trouble. Psalm 91, verses 1 and 2, which are special words to me. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to Yahweh, my refuge, my fortress, my God, in whom I trust. So David wants them to know, kind of as a, not, whatever you're going to say to me, you need to understand. I am a Yahweh refugee. Not that I'm running away from life, but I am running to the Lord. He is my refuge and my challenge. But David is getting advice from others. And he's getting others who are speaking in his life. So you'll notice he responds, having said this, how can you say to my soul, flee like a bird? Who are the you? Who's the you to whom he's speaking? Well, some think that it's David, as it were, talking to himself, talking to his own fears, just like he says, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is in me. Some saying, David, don't you say this to your soul. That's possible. Others think it's the enemies who are taunting him. And those who are saying, you know, you're in real trouble, run, run. But almost certainly it's neither of those. Almost certainly it's David's friends, people who care about him, people who are concerned about him, who see that he is in very real danger, and if he's in real danger, so are they. And they speak out of love for him and concern for him. And they think that this is the best thing he can do, to save himself, preserve yourself. When things are falling apart, look after number one. And they're perhaps concerned because they believe that he's the one that God is going to use, and if he goes down, they'll go down. One commentator makes a very interesting point at this time. He says, the love of your friends will often create your most subtle temptations. People who in one way want the best for you. Now, this bears no resemblance to that, but I think back in my own life, when I was graduating from university, And I was deeply in love with Elizabeth, and I intended to ask her to marry me, and we were moving in that direction. My professor came to me, one of my classes, my anthropology professor came to me and said, Gary, I want you as a graduate student. I want you to come and take your master's degree. I'll pay for everything. I want you to do some research with me, and we can work on this, and you'll get your degree, and then whatever else you planned. And I was heading for seminary. I was going to go on in that particular way, but I hated the idea of leaving Elizabeth for a year and being separated from her. Now, she never put, it wasn't her words that put the temptation for me, but it was a very real temptation. Why not detour from what you believe God's plan is for your life and go in this different direction? But I also had this recognition in my life that if I detoured, then I might stay on the detour instead of what the Lord wanted for me. And even in our own lives, the number one hindrance I've mentioned before for young people heading to the mission field is parents and grandparents who don't want to be removed from their grandkids. And sometimes the love of our friends can be the most subtle kind of temptation that comes into our life. Those of us who are giving advice need to remember that in different occasions. Now, these people were fact-based in their evaluation of what was going on. Their advice was, David, flee. Preserve yourself. You're like a little bird here, and they're going to trap you like a bird. And what will happen then? There are wicked people out there. That's what they say in verse 2. These are people who are determined they are wicked. Their concern is not for God, their concern is for themselves. Their purpose is not to make things better, it's to enrich themselves. And they've got their bows strung, they've got their arrows in place, and they're planning a nighttime attack. It will be hidden, it will be covered, it will be not open and manifest, but they're coming after you. And David, if the foundations are being destroyed, if we're seeing things collapse, what can the righteous do? Why would you stay in a place where everything's coming down on your head? It's easier just to flee, to find a place of self-protection and to go in that way. When I read that, I can't help but think that it's tempting to respond in that way to the world in which we live. Because it's hard not to be realistic about our society and not to say foundations are being destroyed. The moral pillars and some of the things that are going on are not just sort of movement in the same direction. Fundamental changes in the way the country lives. Arnold Toynbee made a statement, the great British historian, civilizations die by suicide, not by murder. And I think our culture is in many ways, and Western culture is dying by suicide in terms of the values. Let me just think with you some. I just wrote them down. This is obviously a list that can be debated and gone back and forth, but it strikes me that these are some of the things that are going on. We witness the unraveling of family life. We see it in a couple of ways. The devastation of divorce, and that has been going on in significant ways over the course of time, and the increasing destruction. So now, rather than people moving toward marriage, they're moving toward common law and temporary relationships. And we see marriage not only being postponed, but many living outside and even doubting the value of marriage. And we see the number of single family parents growing exponentially, so more children are born out of the bonds of marriage than are born within the bonds of marriage. And so some never live with their biological father, some never live in a stable kind of family relationship. We have the redefinition of sexual standards and moral values. We've watched it most obviously in the area of homosexuality. But at the same time, we've moved beyond homosexuality, and that's now to transgender. and the unleashing of gender from biological reality and sexuality, so that you're not even allowed to speak against these kind of things. And we see that agenda being imposed increasingly in different ways by government and judicial mandates. And the require of approval for this kind of progressive, as it's called, morality, which is progressing immorality in so many different ways. Thirdly, we have the desensitizing of human dignity by the ongoing prevalence of abortion and by the increasing adoption of euthanasia. Now, whatever you might want to say about limited places when either of those may be in place, we've got political parties that will not even allow you to run for those political parties if you do not take a stand in terms of favor of those things. And even to watch what happened yesterday in Ireland. Now, whatever else I believe about Ireland and its Catholic background, and I am not in favor of Catholic teaching and certainly in the gospel, but when you see the country celebrating as they did this overturning of that with this indication that women's rights are more important than babies' rights, just for the sake of women's rights, and certainly women's rights are a critical issue that need to be ongoingly expressed. We see how quickly we've moved in different directions. Ireland, of all places, would have been the last that you would have expected to do that. You've got, in another way, the enthronement of the term you've heard me use, expressive individualism or personal autonomy, as the basic moral principle of our time, which says that whatever choices a person makes are his rightly to make, and you shouldn't judge them. They are free to make whatever choices they make. Now, that only usually goes until you make a choice against progressive morality, as they tend to express it. There is the post-truth mindset that privileges emotions over facts. So post-truth has become a word, and post-truth exists on the left, but it also exists on the right. Because on the right, on the certain fringes of the right, it is as unhinged from biblical morality as it can be on the other side. There is a hard secularism that restricts religion to the private sphere, excluding it from the public sphere. It is no small matter that people have begun to talk about freedom of worship rather than freedom of religion. Because freedom of religion means you can come in here into this nice room and be here, and you're free to do whatever you want. Just don't take it outside the door into your workplace or in other kinds of areas. But that was not what freedom of religion was meant to say in the Constitution, and it's not what needs to happen in our world. A growing lack of tolerance for traditional values that violate non-progressive norms, a troubling turn to mass violence. Malcolm Gladwell made the point that every act of mass violence lowers the tolerance level, and you can expect more to happen. And that's exactly what we've seen, witnessing this increasing one happens, and then others feel privileged to join in and do it as well. So even in these last weeks, we're seeing increasing numbers. And we could go on, we could talk about the endorsement of government of marijuana as a recreational drug and the ongoing increasing opioid crisis that we don't seem to be able to get a handle on in this country. So it's not hard to stand back and say, what do we do? The foundations are breaking. But David responds. David responds in an interesting way in verse 1. You notice? How can you say to my soul, flee? He's indignant that they would even suggest that his answer is, seek your own peace, seek your own security, seek your own freedom. How can you say, flee? How could you say that to me? It violates the fact that I believe Yahweh is my refuge. And I believe I'm in his hands and in his care. So I'm not going to be like Henny Penny saying that the sky is falling. I'm going to trust a God, and we'll come to this in a minute, who is there whatever the circumstances are. There's all kinds of ways we can flee. We can flee physically, that's what they meant, but we can flee into our own world as well and just kind of close our eyes and shut our ears and get into a little kind of Christian ghetto or a family kind of closing and say, in effect, let the rest of the world go to hell. We're safe in here. And David is saying, no, the answer is not to flee, but interestingly, it's also not to fight. We'll attack back. Now, there was a time and place where David did that, but it's interesting. In all of the attacks of David, of Saul against David, David never got down into what we could call a culture war with Saul. As a matter of fact, there were times where he had Saul at his mercy, and he says, I won't do what Saul would do. And he won't touch the Lord's anointed. The Lord will deal with them. I'm not going to be like Saul to deal with Saul. And even with Absalom, when it became necessary to fight, David was heartbroken that Absalom was caught up in the midst of it. But in the process, he refused to fight in Jerusalem to hold on to Jerusalem. He was willing to move away. Now, David's answer isn't to flee, and it isn't to fight, to join in the culture wars in the sense that you believe the answer is going to come at the issues of politics and on that kind of level. What David does is focus on the Lord. And what he does is fill his mind and fill his friends' minds with the reality of who the God we know is, and to believe that we live under a sovereign God, that while the pillars may change, the eternal pillars are in who God is. So notice, it's very simple. He doesn't elaborate on it at length, but he reminds us of four great truths about God. First of all, the Lord rules. Yahweh is in his holy temple. Yahweh's throne is in heaven. Yahweh's holiness is not affected by the wickedness of men. He is the holy God, and he is seated in heaven. They do not threaten the God who rules all things. And a confidence in the sovereignty of God, that we have a God who is greater. But not only is it God is enthroned in the heavens, notice again, it's Yahweh. It's the God who loves us, the God who's the covenant God of his people, the God who's made covenant promises to his people, the God who is securing and his people. So Yahweh rules. He sits unrivaled, unmoved, unintimidated by all of the wickedness of men. Psalm 2 depicts the nations raging against the Lord, and what it says is, he who sits in the heavens laughs. His purpose is not threatened, even by the corroding of what we see around us. Secondly, the Lord not only sits enthroned, the Lord not only rules, he sees. He's not blind to what is going on. And he emphasizes that in the simplest possible way. His eyes see. His eyelids test the children of men. He's engaged. He's observing. This is not a God of deism who set everything in motion and then just let it roll out on its own. This is the God who sees, who knows, who's aware, who, as we'll look at next week when we look at Psalm 139, sees all there is to know about me and all about my circumstances and all my situations. And he is not ignorant of what was threatening David. And even though David went at times through his life where he wondered, as you have in many of the Psalms, where are you? In his heart of his heart, he knew that God is not only a sovereign God, he is a seeing God. But he's also a judging God. So, as he describes what is happening, he says, Yahweh tests the righteous. I want you to notice that word, because he said he sees the children of men. His eyelids test the children of men. The Lord tests the righteous. Now, that's a word that we've seen in the book of 1 Peter, because it's a word for a refiner, a metal worker who's testing to purify and refine. And he says the Lord brings hard times on people. There's the fire, but for believers, it is a testing fire, a refining fire. It's the kind of expression that Job uses in Job 23 when he says, when he has tried me, I will come forth like gold. So the righteous come under the judgment of God and the discipline of God, but it is not to destroy them, but to refine them and to purify them and to make them to be what is more honoring and pleasing to him. But then he turns in the other direction and he says that same God who tests the righteous hates the wicked and the ones who love violence. Now there's a sense in which we all know that hate is the flip side of love. If I genuinely love my wife and my children and my grandchildren, then if you come after them to do them harm, you are going to know the fullness of my wrath and my anger. I'm not going to let you touch them. I'm not going to let you abuse them. I'm not going to allow you to get away with what you do. That's why instinctively, even in a society that says there are no objective moral values, there are no absolute values, a society that says that over and over, and then you get engaged in child abuse. And there will be an immediate cry from every side, because instinctively at a level we cannot die in the core of our being, we hate that kind of behavior that destroys what is defenseless and needs protection. And God is a God who, in one sense, hates the wicked. Now, he longs for them, and there's a sense in which he loves them and invites them to come, but there's another sense in which he hates them, and he will bring judgment upon them. So it's interesting that there is a testing fire that refines the wicked, but there is a fire that comes upon the unrighteous, and what it is fire and sulfur and brimstone. Where do you find that in the Old Testament? What's he referring to? That's the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah, when God rained fire and brimstone, and that destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah for their sin and their rebellion against God becomes a symbol in the New Testament of hell itself. God judges. There will come a time when God's judgment, and those who pay, as the old preacher would say, will understand there is payday someday. And that payday is not destruction in the sense of annihilation. It is destruction in eternal judgment before a holy God. But if God rules, and if God sees, and if God judges, God also rewards. So in verse 7, David says, but Yahweh is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. Now we know, in the light of the rest of the Bible, that all our righteousness are as filthy rags before God. But the wonder is the righteous deeds of Christ are credited to our account. And God sees us in his sight as righteous. But God's Spirit also comes into our life and begins to enable us to do good works that please God. And so the God who is righteous, who loves what is righteous, and makes us righteous before him, and enables us to do what is righteous, the promise is the upright will see his face. That was the great blessing. If you remember in the book of Numbers, the Lord will lift up his face upon countenance upon you and give you peace. To see the face of God was to be accepted by him and approved by him. I've mentioned before that my son worked, when we lived in Dallas, at an exclusive hotel, and they had all kinds of Saudis come, and they were of the royal family, and they had their retinue that they brought with them, Now, the job that Stephen had, he would go into different things and help in different ways. But when one of the Saudi subjects came into the presence of royalty, they had to come and they keep their head down until the ruler, the prince, or whoever would say something, and then they could lift up their face and they could see him. And in that kind of world, the privilege of seeing the face of the king is a sign of ultimate acceptance. And the promise is, beloved, it does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is, face to face. Some of you remember the old gospel song, face to face with Christ my Savior, face to face, what will it be? When beauty I behold him, Jesus Christ who died for me. And that is the promise even as we live in this world. God is sovereign. And even though the foundations are shaking, the foundations of God's church are not being shaken. Christ is the foundation. Christ is the cornerstone. Christ is the rock. And God's church is not dependent on any country. And so we can look at places in the world and we can see where God's church was once strong and the government was once strong, but now we go and see the ruins of those places. But God's church goes on. God is sovereign. God sees, he knows us in this situation. What is happening in our culture is not taking God by surprise, although sometimes it just takes me by enormous surprise. How did we get here from there? But God's not surprised. And God is not going to let it go unjudged, but in his time and in his way. But our promise is, he is our refuge. He is our stronghold. He doesn't call us to flee. He doesn't call us to fight, at least in the terms of the world's fight. He does call us to proclaim and to live out the gospel. But most of all, he calls us to focus on our God, who is absolutely unchanging and who is constantly the God who cares and keeps his people.